Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
We hear a lot about the earth, the wild, the rivers and lakes and wonders. We care about air, water and healthy food and sustainability, and now connecting the wild places, and well, we've come a long way in a relatively short period of time. When we return, America's Johnny Appleseed of environmental awareness, Dennis Hayes, a living legend who has helped this planet and its life live. He's looking to the future when we return here on the Wildside News.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Welcome back. Yes, indeed. This is a show about legends, the humankind, heroes, people who have made a significant impact on our lives. The Wildside News is proud to welcome, yes, a legend, Dennis Hayes, whose early vision of our Earth, his sense that people needed to come together and join our minds and spirit in united action, led to the birth of the very first Earth Day in 1970. Dennis Hayes, for those who know him, I'll let his accomplishments speak for themselves. Dennis is president of the Bullitt Foundation. He was national coordinator of the first Earth Day. He chairs the International Earth Day Network. During the Carter administration, he served as director of the National Renewable Energy Laboratory. In 1979, Dennis received the National Jefferson Medal for Greatest Public Service by an individual under 35. He received the John Muir Award from the Sierra Club and the highest honors awarded by the National Wildlife Federation, the Humane Society, and the Interfaith Center for Corporate Responsibility. Time magazine selected Hayes as one of its heroes of the planet, and the National Audubon Society included him on its list of 100 environmental heroes of the 20th century. And actually, it just keeps on going. Dennis, I want to welcome you. I'm honored to have you on the Wildside News.
Sydney, you've got me so embarrassed I'm getting tongue-tied.
Well, and you're humble, too? Okay. Anyway, Dennis, you know, there's been very few people who bring to this moment, right now, such a lifetime of involvement in truly carrying a sense of responsibility and mission as you do. I know it may sound like a bit of a cliché, but I mean this in all sincerity. How are we doing?
Well, first I want to say, Sydney, that while I appreciate all of these extraordinarily complimentary remarks, the environmental movement has really functioned as a movement, and every now and then one of us gets thrust in front of the microphone or has the opportunity to do something that is relatively high profile, but the strength comes from the tens and tens of millions of people who care passionately and will put their bodies on the line, put their checkbooks on the line, put their lifestyles on the line. Today in the United States, we've literally got many tens of millions of people who have altered their diets, altered their purchase of automobiles, decided on their family size, decided where they're going to live, and what kind of, I mean, just thing after thing on the basis of environmental values. That is the thing that has given it its political traction and its ability to have a substantial impact when it gets itself organized to do so. I think the short answer, having already given a long answer, though, directly to your question, is that at local sorts of things, we've made a great many improvements. The air is cleaner, the water is cleaner, we've saved a number of species that were on the verge of extinction, and even up through the national level, America is in better shape in many ways today than it was in 1970. At the global level, however, we've been dramatically less successful. In fact, of the major environmental threats facing the planet, say in 1970 at the time of the first Earth Day, the only one that we've made really significant progress on, I believe, would be the depletion of atmospheric ozone. In every other major area, the world is in worse shape today than it was 34 years ago.
So, there was such a sense of hope and unity in 1970 when this began. You've kind of addressed that, and literally millions of people came together. And this movement certainly has been mainstreamed. I mean, we take it all for granted. People who are born now just assumed this is the way the world was. And of course, it took the beginning of this movement to back up with Earth Day. And then, as you say, it was a very personal thing. But what's the health of our hope now as we look to the future? Because we do face some daunting challenges.
Well, we face a huge number of daunting challenges. If I were trying to come up with the handful of biggies, they would be the rapid extinction, almost an epidemic of extinction sweeping around the planet as we wipe out particular ecosystems that were designed by nature over hundreds of millions of years to provide a useful habitat for key species. The rapid growth of human population, it has tapered off a little bit, but we are now at something over 6.5 billion people, and given the way the population is structured, even if we knew how to throw on the brakes on population growth, it's hard to see how we could avoid hitting 9 billion. And that's getting to be just an awesome number of people, particularly as they all increasingly aspire toward Western lifestyles. And finally, the one that has received a fair amount of attention and in some sense would be the easiest to solve, although we're not doing much to solve it, that interface between climate and energy, moving the whole species, which has largely built an industrial civilization around the use of fossil fuels and has now discovered that whenever you burn carbon, you are changing the climate. We need to pull it off of fossil fuels at this moment and move it onto something that is benign, renewable, doesn't produce any bombs, doesn't change the climate, but will give us the energy that we need to continue to lead satisfactory lives.
Well, so how are we supposed to initiate this change and this action?
Well,
I'm putting it on you.
At the moment, I suspect we're not going to be able to rely upon presidential leadership from the current administration, which has produced an energy plan that is a ratification of 19th century ideas about energy. To the extent that it comes politically from on top, and that's the easiest way for it to happen, we're going to have political change on top in the White House and in the Congress. But at some point, some companies have to start making these things, these photovoltaic arrays and all of the components for passive building designs and the renewable fuels and the wind turbines and other things. And the tragedy is that in most of those areas, it was American companies, often paid for with American taxpayers' dollars, that came up with the first innovative wind turbine designs, discovered the photovoltaics as something that could be used, and then began to apply it to the space race, and then discovered a dozen different semiconductor materials that you can use now to produce photovoltaic cells. And after all of that investment and all of that leadership, we walked away from it in the Reagan administration, and now the leadership has turned to Japan and Germany, who are doing spectacularly better than we are, but still grossly inadequate to the challenges that are facing the planet. The answer, I mean, I can give you five or six relatively boring policies. Important would be, I think, federal procurement. If the federal government did for photovoltaic cells what it did for computer chips, what it did for jet engines, what it's done for all kinds of drugs, and just buy them and buy them and buy them until through economies of mass production, the price comes down to the point where they take off on their own in the private sector, that kind of transformational thing could move us swiftly off the dime in the course of 3 to 5 years.
Now, if you were to outline, let's say that you were in charge of this this plan here, what would be some of the most critical actual changes that you would initiate? Let's say in America. Let's start with America here.
Okay. Now, are these technological changes or policy changes?
Let's start with technological changes. What could we actually do? Because, you know, we really have to do something.
Yeah. Well, basically, we now have a transportation system that is governed by gasoline that everybody complains about when it costs $2 a gallon, although in the rest of the industrialized world, and in Europe and Japan, because they've got taxes on it, because they want to build a higher degree of national security and a more efficient transportation system, it costs anywhere from $4.50 to $6 a barrel, $6 a gallon.
Mm-hmm.
I would change, you'd have to phase it in because this is going to be enormously disruptive, but I would start applying the same kind of taxes here that Europe and Japan does, weaning us off of our dependence on Middle Eastern oil and using less gasoline per mile traveled dramatically, which then begins to change the nature of the vehicle fleet and also raises an enormous amount of money. I mean, every dollar of gasoline taxes is $100 billion of federal revenue at a time when our national debt is now that's $7.3 trillion and skyrocketing. And another, I guess the whole characterization of the first set of things I do would be dramatically increasing the efficiency with which we use energy. Because energy has been so very cheap, we've built a society that uses an enormous amount of it. And it's cheap because we externalize, you know, the acid rain, we externalize all of these other variables. And if we internalize them in the prices, we'd start substituting human ingenuity, we'd start substituting capital investment, we'd substitute labor, we'd substitute all sorts of things for energy. So we should have far more efficient buildings, more efficient industrial processes, more efficient transportation system, and more efficient appliances, more efficient lights, just straight across the board. In many of those cases, these things are dominated by federal standards. There are appliance efficiency standards for all kinds of appliances. Many of them have been just dramatically effective in the way that they've reduced the amount of energy, for example, used by refrigerators. If the refrigerator, the average refrigerator you bought today, were the same energy glutton as the average refrigerator that was bought 20 years ago in the United States, this country would need something like 8 large nuclear power plants just to run the inefficiency of the refrigerator.
Wow. You know, you've talked about things that are happening, for example, in Germany and Japan. And I know from your perspective, some really cutting-edge policies and technologies are coming together in those countries to really make a difference. Why don't you share some of those perceptions?
Well, the one that I'm principally most excited about myself, because I believe that in the long run, if you're going to be meeting this kind of global transition in energy, which at the lower end, if you've just knocked the socks off of everybody and what you do on efficiency, but the population does go to 9 billion and you have any kind of reasonable economic growth over the course of the next 25 or 30 years, you get a demand of about 30 terawatts of power that the world needs. And if you look at benign renewable sources, you can get some of that from hydropower, some of it from wind, some of it from biological fuels. But you add all of those things together, throw in geothermal, and you're going to be stretching it probably to get 6-7 terawatts. And to get the balance of that, you need to either turn to coal, which changes the climate, to nuclear, which leads to the proliferation of weapons, as we've seen in North Korea, and Iran, and Pakistan, India, Israel. Or you turn to the sun. What Germany has done to promote solar electricity has been to address the fundamental market problem of solar, which is that everybody knows that the price of solar energy is going down and that it will be cheaper 3 or 4 years from now than it is today. So everybody is postponing buying solar until it gets cheaper. But because so few people are buying it, it's getting cheaper only at a very, very slow rate. So the Germans said, what can we do to goose this? And the best thing we can do is to make people indifferent as to whether they buy it today or buy it 4 years from now. So if you buy a photovoltaic array and put it on your rooftop in any place in Germany today to produce electricity, the grid, the power company, will buy all the electricity that you produce at the cost to you of producing it. So today they estimate that that's 47 cents a kilowatt hour. So if you buy the PV array, put it in, every kilowatt hour that you produce, you get 47 cents for. So you're marketplace neutral. It hasn't cost you anything. And you'll continue to receive that for the next 20 years. And then next year, when they buy it and the price has fallen to 30 cents, they'll pay you 30 cents for the next 20 years. Until they get down, they think, in 4 or 5 years with this, to the point where it's going to be way under 10 cents, possibly as low as 5 or 6 cents, though Germany is such a lousy solar country.
Right.
That, you know, if you could do it for 10 cents in Germany, you can do it for 4 cents in Arizona. In any case, they are driving it down the learning curve just as we did with computer chips, but they're doing it with photovoltaic cells.
Well, of course, you know, it's my belief, and we've talked about this, that it really is going to take a radical restructuring. I don't know any other answer, and one of the models for that I am intrigued by is, of course, the Apollo Alliance, and I know that you're familiar with some of their work, and they're suggesting that if we were to really, from the top on down, from the presidential level, mandate this as one of America's greatest challenges, just like heading to the moon, was that we could probably make significant differences in 10 years and put people back to work by the millions, develop new technologies, and who even knows. What are your feelings about that?
I think that it's a terrific idea. It summons this call to creativity, to scientific excellence. It might start getting Americans graduate schools of science and engineering, which are having lower attendance of American students every year, and get us back as we did with Sputnik, and as we did with the Manhattan Project, where students started suddenly going back into those fields, which is where the country needs to be if we're going to have any kind of economic advantage in a future increasingly globalized world. So I'm wildly enthusiastic about it. It's got a high, well, it actually, in real terms, over 10 years, it's not that high. It's a $30 billion, $3 billion a year program. It's inconceivable that the Bush administration would jump on this particular bandwagon, but I think it's entirely possible that something very akin to this, possibly even something more ambitious than this, could come out of a Kerry Edwards administration.
Well, that's very inspiring and certainly encouraging in these days. And Dennis, we could go. There's many, many things that we could share because you have such an incredible perspective. I would like to learn about the Bullitt Foundation, where you work now, and talk about that mission, if you would.
Oh, sure. The Bullitt Foundation was set up with the proceeds of the sale of a series of television stations that were networked together by a woman named Dorothy Bullitt, who built the first television station in the Pacific Northwest. When she died at the age of 96, her children put the overwhelming bulk of her estate into this foundation that has as its mission to try to convert the Pacific Northwest, the place where the signal of King Broadcasting used to reach, into a model of sustainable development. The theory being that this is arguably the richest, the best educated, the most environmentally conscious corner of human civilization, perhaps ever in history. And if we can't build that kind of a model here in Washington, Oregon, Idaho, Montana, British Columbia, and Alaska, it's hard to imagine where we could.
You know, you can contact the Bullitt Foundation. How?
Well, we only fund in the Pacific Northwest,
okay.
But we're at www.bullitt.org.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Dennis Hayes. I wish for you all that is needed to bring this forward. And I invite you back anytime. Please live long, and may all your dreams come true. We'll talk again on the Wild Side News when we return. Mm-hmm.